Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 33, Jack Kirby, the DC Years, 1972 to 1975. I left off last time I talked about Jack Kirby with the end of the New Gods. There are a number of people who've written about how Jack took the end of the New Gods. They all say approximately the same thing, that he was told by Carmine Infantino, who was the executive editor at DC, that the New Gods were canceled on a Friday, that the New Gods were done, that the issues he had in the works, issues 11 of each series, were to be the last ones. Except for Mr. Miracle. Mr. Miracle would continue, but he was not to further the New Gods story. Every report I read said that Jack was extremely upset about it that Friday, but by Monday, he was back at work, creating new ideas, doing new things, as if it didn't matter. I have to admit, looking at Jack's work, knowing my own life, I have trouble believing this. I know that the people who've written about Jack's reaction were his close friends. But you never know what's inside someone's heart. You never know what they're really feeling. Especially when, at the time, Mark Evanier worked for him. And Jack always felt the burden of making sure that there was enough money for his family. He never wanted anybody out of work. Me, if it were me, if I had left a company I was unhappy at to go to a company that said that they would support me, that they were open to all my new ideas, and then one by one they all got shot down. The idea of the New Gods being collected in graphic albums, the idea of black and white magazines aimed at older readers. And now all these ideas that I had held for years and being told that it was done. I wouldn't take that very well. I would be upset. And I have to say that when you look at Jack's work after the cancellation of the New Gods, it does take a step down in creativity. The stories are simpler. The stories don't have as many new characters and new ideas. There's not that boundless sense of pure Kirby creativity blasting off the page. You can look at Commandy and The Demon and Omak and other books, and they're still good. It's still great Kirby work. But it doesn't have that explosive quality that the New Gods had. A couple other things I find very interesting about the fact that the New Gods was canceled, and one is that Kirby had kind of moved Darkseid into the Superman mythos when Morgan Edge, who was the head of the communication company that bought the Daily Planet, he was a minion of Darkseid. That was gotten rid of pretty easily. Darkseid, who's now one of DC's biggest villains, pretty much gone. The New Gods characters, all pretty much put to the side. DC didn't use them. So Jack, being Jack Kirby, had new books ready immediately. The first one was Commandy. Commandy, the last boy on Earth, and the most successful thing that he did at DC in the 70s. Commandy was the story of, after the great disaster, humans were the animals, and animals had evolved to have speech and civilizations and weapons. And Commandy, who had been raised by his grandfather, had been locked away, had been taught how to read, had been taught how to speak, had been taught all these things, and he escaped, and he was our conduit into this world. A lot of people looked at it as a Planet of the Apes ripoff because on the cover, there's Commandy in a boat flowing in turbulent waters with the Statue of Liberty broken in the background. And then, oh, it's a planet where apes evolved from men, for Planet of the Apes. This is... But the thing about Kamandi that a lot of people didn't know, and I honestly didn't know until I dug into the research, was Kamandi was where Kirby took one of his old ideas. He had a comic strip idea back in the 50s. And because DC said, all right, we need new books from you, he changed it around, he refit it, and he turned it into this series. Kamandi was the most successful work Kirby did at DC. Kirby worked on it for 40 issues until he left for Marvel, and it lasted a number of issues after he left. There have been a couple of attempts to revive it by other people, but it hasn't really worked. I have recently read the Kamandi stories. I'm actually halfway through Kirby's run. I just finished up the second archive, and I have now picked up the Kirby Kamandi Omnibus Volume 2. What it was, they were putting it out as archives for the first two, and then as the DC's archive program went away, they put those stories out as a omnibus, the first 20 in one omnibus, the second 20 in another. And the stories are simpler. While it's a great series, it's a lot of fun to read, it's still Kirby at his art is still amazing and vibrant. The stories are much simpler. There's not a lot of complexity to them. They're just very basic adventure stories. And they really read as if they're aimed at kids 8 to 14. And I wonder if DC Editorial said, quit doing this stuff. DC was very well known for, we do children's stories. If you look at Superman and Batman, through the 60s, they're children's stories. They're aimed at children, and there were a number of DC editors who looked down upon their audience and actually would say things like, we make comics for, we do stories for slightly slow children. Kamandi is one of those books that's very enjoyable. I understand that there are people who really like it. To me, it's a step down from the New Gods. Kirby also, at the same time, had another book called The Demon. And Mark Evanier has written a number of times about how they were all out to dinner. Jack, his wife, Roz, him, and I think Steve Skeets, and a couple other people. And they were talking, and Kirby grabbed a napkin and started sketching out a face of a mask he remembered from an old Prince Valiant story. And once he started doing that, the conversations that he was having were done. He was in creative mode, and he was working on stuff at the table. And by the time they got home from this, Jack went into the drawing board and started drawing and worked all night and got the first issue done. The Demon was a different sort of adventure story, and I haven't been able to find a whole lot of detail on the creation. But if you look at what DC was putting out at the time, DC was having limited success with their mystery books. And I put mystery in quotes because they were really horror books, but DC was scared to use the word horror because of the comics code. But they had a number of these books at the time. They had the Secrets of the Sinister House. They had House of Mystery, House of Secrets, The Witching Hour. And they were meeting limited success. They were selling well, and they made a lot of profit because at the time DC, for their mystery books, were using Filipino artists who they could pay a lot less than they paid American artists. So they would have young, upcoming writers, people who were just trying to break into the business, write these short stories. They would send them off to the Philippines. There was a studio there that worked on these, and stories would get sent there, they would get drawn and sent back. And one of the weird things about DC that I've learned in the last few months is that they were 6 months ahead of their deadlines. And they were so far ahead on deadlines that they had tons of inventory stuff. So they could deal with the fact that they're shipping a story over to the Philippines and then the artwork is being physically shipped back. This was in the 70s when you couldn't do electronic transfer. It was hard to get mail. And because they were so far ahead, they could do it very cheaply. So I imagine one of the things either Kirby sought or Carmine Infantino asked for was, hey, these horror books, they're selling well. Why don't you do a horror-themed book? The Demon was about a man, Jason Blood, who shared his body with Etrigan the Demon. The book ran 16 issues. There was a lot of Arthurian thrust to it. There were a lot of ties back to the time of King Arthur. And when Kirby used demons, he didn't get into the 70s satanic sort of exorcist style of stuff. For him, it was much more like action movies and Kirby action stories. These books sold okay. As I said, they only lasted 16 issues. DC has put this entire series out in an omnibus as well. It's worth reading. It's, again, it's not as complicated as the New Gods. It's not as rich as the New Gods. It's another book that, when it got canceled, kind of went away. DC didn't mention it much until in 1996 when Matt Wagner, I'm sorry, 1986, when Matt Wagner, fresh off his success on Mage, came over and did a mini-series based on Alan Moore's interpretation of the character from Swamp Thing. When Alan Moore got the character, he got the idea of it being a rhyming demon, where Etrigan always spoke in rhyme. Matt Wagner picked that up and used it, and then a few years later there was a demon series that lasted over 5 years. That was one of the first series that Garth Ennis worked on, believe it or not. And the character was minorly successful through the 90s. Then in the 2000s, John Byrne got it and wanted to bring it back to the original form. He got rid of the rhyming. He got rid of all the additions. I found John Byrne's version of the demon unreadable. It was when Byrne was... It was Byrne's late period at DC where it really felt like he was more had axes to grind than stories to tell. But when you pick up that book of the demon, you can see that Kirby is very much doing Kirby style horror. It reminds me a lot of the Black Magic stuff and Strange World of Your Dreams from the 50s, in that he goes with very dark imagery. The coloring is also very dark, very bold lines, a lot of darkness in his work. I've never really been a fan of Kirby's horror that much because I don't feel it's one of his stronger suits. His stuff tends to be more strange than horror, but it's still a good read. It's well worth reading. The other thing that was going on at the time was Simon and Kirby had licensed the rights to their old Black Magic comic, one of the ones that they created at their own comic book publisher. So DC was reprinting the Black Magic stuff as its own series. So there was really a horror boom going on at the time. Over at Marvel, they had a number of books that reprinted the Atlas stuff from the 50s, and they were reprinting a lot of Kirby work in there. Reprinting a lot of Kirby and Ditko and Don Heck stuff in those books, especially the Kirby Monster stuff. But Marvel had also started doing horror heroes. They had horror themes and horror characters, but it was still within that Marvel superhero thing, where it was werewolf by night versus somebody, or the mummy versus somebody, or Ghost Rider. Dracula was more of a horror soap opera type, but it also had fight scenes in it. The Frankenstein Monster. Ooh, that was a mess of a series, changing direction every 4 or 5 issues, but it also Frankenstein with fight scenes. The greatest of Marvel's horror books at the time, of course, was Man-Thing by Steve Gerber, which played with conventions. It was very much a guy in his young 20s who wanted to see what he could do with the medium within the boundaries that Marvel had set. Over at DC, Kirby was doing Kirby-style stories in a horror setting. The other thing that was going on at DC is Joe Simon was pitching ideas to DC as well. DC's sales were in free fall by 72, 73. Nothing was working. Nothing was selling well. You could look at the time and they would throw out an idea and it would be canceled within 4 or 5 issues, especially by the time you got to 75. There's so many DC books that lasted like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 issues around that time. And Joe Simon was pitching ideas to him. He had done a series in the 60s called Brother Power the Geek that had only lasted 2 issues. And I've read it and it's very weird. It's very much an old man looking at the youth culture and trying to figure it out in a comic book and failing miserably. But DC decided they wanted to see a Simon and Kirby reunion. And Simon and Kirby, they were okay with this. They were both kind of floundering at DC. They were both trying to find their way, both trying to get something that had some gears under them. So they worked on an idea called The Sandman. And The Sandman was only supposed to be a one-issue shot. It was supposed to be the great reunion of Simon and Kirby. And this was back when everything in comics was a series. And if they did one-shots, they usually had it in an anthology book, such as Showcase or First Issue Special. Over at Marvel, it was Marvel Spotlight and Marvel Premiere. Comics were geared towards series. But they were going to put out a one-shot, a one-issue Simon and Kirby reunion called The Sandman. And when it came out, it sold better than all expectations, sold better than most of DC's line. It had a sell-through, some reports I read, it had a sell-through of over 90%, which means that of all the comics they printed and shipped out during the returnable era, 90% of them sold. So they only got 10% from dealers who said this didn't sell and returned the cover. Joe Simon had already moved on by the time the sales reports came in. He'd given up on that and had moved on to other things. But Kirby was under contract, and with Sandman selling so well, DC decided they were going to turn it into a series. Now, Sandman is, it feels very 40s. When you read it now, it feels like a very 40s series. The idea is that the character, the Sandman, is the character who he lives in the dream dimension. And if people are having nightmares, he goes into your dream to fix them, to defeat whatever is causing these nightmares. A little like Strange World of Your Dreams, which Simon and Kirby did in the 50s. And the Sandman, who had 2 helpers who were very weird Kirby designs. It was a very strange idea for a series. And it seemed to straddle the line between adventure and horror and fantasy in a way that no one else really would have even tried. The thing that's odd is when DC said turn it into a series, they thought the reason it was successful was because Kirby didn't write it. They felt that it was Joe Simon writing it, Kirby drawing it. That must be why it was successful. So Kirby was actually teamed with writers on the Sandman book. And to me, that's why it really didn't gel. It only lasted a few issues. So that first issue sold phenomenally. The rest just kind of either didn't sell or whatever happened, because it's very hard to know with DC. And we'll get to that in a bit. But those stories are very strange. They still have the Kirby action, but they seem very... The plots are dull, and Kirby's action saves them. We don't know how much Kirby changed any of the plots he was given. We don't know how much input he had, but I do know that the scripting by Michael Fleischer was very, very flat. It didn't have that energy. It didn't have that crackle. It didn't have the excitement. The Sandman is an interesting read. The first issue is really nostalgic in a lot of ways. Goes back to that feeling of a Simon and Kirby book from the 40s or 50s where it's, okay, we're just throwing an idea out here. It may be weird, it may not work, but we're going to do it. Now, I talked in the previous episode about how Kirby had a contract to deliver a certain number of pages to DC, and they would pay him a certain amount for those pages. Kirby was working very far ahead. So if you look at the timeline of when books are published, Commandy and the Demon were coming out as the last issues of the New Gods were coming out as well. So Kirby was working really far ahead compared to Marvel. But he also had those number of pages, which is why you see a lot of Kirby stuff here and there. Kirby didn't do a lot of covers at DC toward the end of his tenure there. DC preferred covers by Joe Kubert, covers, you know, Neil Adams style covers. But really, the Joe Kubert sort of sketchy illustrative cover was what DC felt sold at the time. So as you look on a lot of stuff, as you get later into Kirby's tenure at DC, you can see his autonomy being chipped away. He's being paired with writers. He's not doing his own covers. You actually got paid more for covers back then. So Kirby's frustration at DC was very evident, and their frustration with him seemed very evident. There's no evidence for me to support this. This is just an opinion. But I do know that when Kirby left DC, the editors at the time were very upset. They didn't want anything to do with him. And while Marvel was rising, the editors at DC would mock the art at Marvel, specifically Kirby, and would actually tell fans in interviews, Marvel's secret is terrible art. Carmine Infantino was brought in as editor-in-chief because DC sales were dropping and Marvels were rising. So he was charged with trying to do something. He stole Marvel's biggest selling artist. And it wasn't working. It just wasn't working. A hidden gem during Kirby's later tenure at DC, which I actually did not read until it came out in an omnibus, was Kirby's run in the comic Our Fighting Forces on the series The Losers. According to both Evanier and Greg Theakston, Kirby did not want to do the series The Losers. It was the only series that Kirby did at DC where he came into something that was already ongoing, other than Jimmy Olsen. The Losers was a World War II book, and Kirby hated the title. He hated the title. He also was a really big fan of DC's preoccupation with death on the covers, and their characters are all beaten down, and their heroes are always, you know, at their greatest defeat on the covers. But DC felt that that's what sold. So he's put onto a series he didn't create. It's called The Losers. And for those reasons, because I'd heard about that, I kind of didn't read it. I'm also not a big fan of war comics. I like the Kurtzman stuff. I like his war comics. I like the Warren Frontline Combat, Blazing Combat, that lasted four issues. But even at Marvel, I like Kirby's Sergeant Fury, but the Sergeant Fury stuff after that, I just kind of find, I don't care for it. I don't care for war stories. This was also at a time when you had the huge backlash against Vietnam, to the point where on DC's war books, they would end each story, not with the end, but make war no more, trying to have their cake and eat it too. We're going to tell, you know, stories about you know, heroic stuff going on during World War II, and talk about how, you know, oh, we're anti-war, because that's, you know, kind of the prevalent feeling among kids at the time. So Kirby came into our fighting forces doing the losers, and he really just did war action stories. It was the first time he did sort of non-superheroish war stories. They weren't as realistic as his stuff in the 50s. They were still action stories. But anybody who was around Kirby knew that once you got Kirby talking about his time in World War II, forget it, that's all he's talking about for the next, you know, few hours. His run on the losers is the same thing. It's Kirby telling war stories, and it's much more enjoyable than I would have thought. It's, you can almost see that spark come back to his art. The stories are fun and exciting and full of action, and in a lot of, I know a lot of people feel that his second half's work on Commandy is the best. I honestly would believe, in my mind, his run on the losers is an unappreciated gem. I like it more than Commandy. I felt that Kirby did better work on it than in Commandy. And if you're like me and you skipped it for years and years and years, I would go ahead and give it a try. I would jump in on it and just see what you think. Just see if you enjoy it. Because I was actually pretty amazed at how much I enjoyed those stories. I have actually gone back and read them a couple of times, because they're fun action stories. And you could tell that Kirby's enjoying the stuff after he gets past the first few issues. Toward the end of his tenure at DC, it's very clear that Kirby was unhappy. He was negotiating with Marvel to return to Marvel after his time at DC was done. DC, there are mixed reports on whether DC offered him a new contract. There are reports that he was offered a new contract. There are reports that he was offered a new contract with caveats that would be that he would take assignments like any other artist. He wouldn't be his own editor anymore. That he would work with DC's office more closely. And you could see toward the end of his run at DC that more and more of this was going on. He did issues, at least one issue of Richard Dragon, Kung Fu Fighter, which was DC's attempt at a Kung Fu series. He was the penciler only on Justice Incorporated, which was a pulp adaptation of a character called the Avenger, which was a character who was created by Kenneth Robeson. Also, well, his real name was Lester Dent, but his pen name was Kenneth Robeson, the creator of Doc Savage. It was another pulp series from the 30s that came from that fiction house. And he did the first issue of Cobra, which is a character that became a long-running villain at DC. Kirby kind of was just, okay, we got to fill out the contract. Here you go. There were some odd one-offs that came out. There was a new Kirby Manhunter, because he had worked on the Manhunter in the 40s. And DC thought that bringing that character back with Kirby on it might do something. He did a first issue, which was published in First Issue Special. And then there's the one that a lot of people tend to point at and make fun of, and that's the comic Dingbats of Danger Street. This was another thing where DC went to Kirby and said, look, maybe Kid Gangs. You had so much success with Kid Gangs, with, you know, Boy Commandos and things like that in the 40s. Let's try a new Kid Gang. And Kirby had kind of brought them back in Jimmy Olsen. And I thought that the Newsboy Legion in Jimmy Olsen was just a fascinating idea. Kirby got into cloning, he got into genetic engineering, also using, you know, kind of a Kid Gang thing. But by the 70s, the Kid Gang idea, it was big in the 30s and 40s, even in movies, but by the 70s it was considered old hat, it was considered nostalgia. When Kirby created Dingbats of Danger Street, Dingbat was, you know, a big word that was being used because of All in the Family. Archie Bunker would always call somebody stupid a dingbat because he couldn't swear on the air. When you read the story itself, it's a Kirby Kid Gang story. He tries to update it a little bit, but it's very much, here are a bunch of interesting characters. They're all together. They're going to have adventures in kind of a urban world that's one step removed from the current urban world. You know, it's more Kirby's nostalgic view of what it was like when he was a kid running in a gang. Gangs were a little different when Kirby was running in them. Yeah, they were still, you know, there was still a lot of fighting and violence, but he romanticized it, turned it into a comic. I remember when it came out, I was just starting to read comics, and one of the kids on the bus, who was the kid who got me into Marvel, that Marvel was the greatest company ever, and you know, I'm a young kid, I'm really impressionable, I don't know about this world of superheroes. He would always bring up that DC publishes stupid books like Dingbats of Danger Street. And the name just sounds silly, you know, if you're a kid, because, well, why would I want to read a comic about a bunch of dingbats? But Kirby was, you know, doing what he was asked. He was finishing out his contract. In late 1974, Kirby came to terms with Marvel that he would return. He would be a writer-editor. He would be in control of his own books. He would have a certain number of pages a month. He would come back to do Captain America and books that he created. But because DC was so far ahead, Kirby continued to have DC stuff come out into 1975 as his Marvel stuff was coming out. So if you go to the Kirby chronology, you could see that, you know, in 75, there was a flood of Kirby work because you had all this DC stuff, him finishing up on Commandy, these one-shot things coming out. Whereas over at Marvel, oh, there's Captain America, there's the Eternals, there's, you know, his other books were starting to fire up. He was doing a lot of covers at Marvel as well. One of the things I find really interesting is by the end of his time at DC, he was doing very few covers of his own work. While once he got to Marvel, they had him doing covers of the Fantastic Four, of Iron Man, of Thor, of the Avengers, of all these other books that he wasn't even drawing. Because Marvel knew a Kirby cover would sell. They wanted that dynamic. They wanted that dynamic work. They wanted that action. They wanted that Kirby feel. They would usually have the covers inked by John Romita, because John Romita inked most of the Marvel covers at the time. Just look at the Gilkane covers that came out. The last real kind of significant work that Kirby did at DC during this period was a series called OMAC, One Man Army Corps. And if you read the first issue of OMAC, it is a retelling of the origin of Captain America, except it's set in a science fiction future. Buddy Blank gets given treatments, and he can become OMAC, the One Man Army Corps. Because it was science fiction, which is one of Kirby's great loves, he was actually going back to the ideas he was throwing out in Jimmy Olsen. It was in a Kirby-esque dystopian future. Most dystopian futures are that, you know, there is no hope, everything is gone. In Kirby's dystopian future, there was order, there was constant order, there was no freedom, there was no choice, you did what you were told. Going back to the New Gods idea of the anti-life is the removal of choice, it's the removal of freedom. So as Kirby did this series, it only lasted a few issues, he populated it with a ton of science fiction ideas. And I do remember as a kid seeing the cover for the first issue, which is, oh, it's a white cover, really striking. And it's OMAC throwing a box that has a head, a woman's head, arms and legs in a weird position, throwing it at the reader. And as a kid, I was so freaked out by it that I wanted nothing to do with that stuff. And I didn't open it. I didn't look at it. I just remember seeing it on the stands and going, oh, that's weird and scary. Oh, that's weird and scary. I can't read it. To the point where, it, again, OMAC was one of the last Kirby books from DC that I tracked down and read. Again, it has been published in a single volume. And while his run on the Losers is my favorite of the late DC Kirby, OMAC is back to, all right, what ideas can I throw at the reader? It's not as, you know, in your face and explosive as the New Gods, but he's still, you know, he gets to play in a science fiction world, and Kirby loved his science fiction. One of the last things about his run at DC that strikes me is how DC sort of brought in people to script over Kirby. Kirby had come to DC because he wanted to do it all himself. He was upset that Stan Lee took credit for what he felt he was doing. And in some ways, he tried to emulate Stan Lee's writing through a Kirby filter. And I think in a lot of ways, the New God stuff really did much better once he got those Stan Lee-isms out of his head. When you get to Commandy, his scripting has really sort of, he's brought it down a bit so it's not as mythic and over the top, so it works better. And then by the end, DC had felt that the reason Kirby's books aren't selling is because he doesn't have a writer. So they'd team him with the writers they had. Gary Conway, Denny O'Neill, Michael Fleischer. And except for one exception, it was the last time Kirby worked with a scripter. If you look at Kirby's tenure, I have to say you have to deem it a failure. DC deemed it a failure. DC felt that Kirby was a sales failure. He came to DC as Marvel's hottest artist, as the guy who drove the Marvel engine, and over at DC, he never really dug his wheels in and had huge sellers. At least that's what they said at the time. There are people who say very different things about the New Gods, and we'll get to that. But DC's editorial at the time was very much, okay, he's gone, that's all right, we're not going to worry about it. It was very soon after Kirby left that Carmine Infantino was removed as executive editor. Carmine himself said a few times that the thing that did him in was the older editors not liking his new ideas and resentment for him bringing in Kirby and giving Kirby whatever he wants. But if you look at what they did with Kirby at DC, you can't say they let Kirby do whatever he wanted. They shot down ideas before they were even tried. I'm not going to say they undermined him, but I will say that he came to them with ideas, and those black and white magazines, I mean, they just kind of plopped them out on the market. They did no marketing whatsoever, and they were canceled with one issue. So you can't even call that an attempt at trying to make them successful. After he left DC and Carmine Infantino was moved out, Jeanette Kahn, who had worked on children's magazines, was brought in to kind of be the president of DC. She was kind of in charge of DC. And as she went through the sales figures, she saw that the New Gods had actually sold better than most of the books DC was publishing at the time. She looked at the raw sales numbers rather than the percentages, whereas DC at the time looked at percentages. And what she has said is the problem with the New Gods wasn't that it didn't sell well. It's that DC thought it would sell above and beyond what Kirby's work had sold at Marvel, so they were printing way too many copies and sending them out. Kirby's work was selling as well as his stuff at Marvel, but because DC was overprinting it, the returns were much higher than the other stuff at DC. So one of the first things she did as publisher was to say, we need to bring the New Gods back. And if you look, there's Return of the New Gods. There was a first issue special that kind of set everything up. Gary Conway and Don Newton did a new Gods. They brought back Mr. Miracle, written by Steve Gerber and Steve Englehart. And the villain Darkseid was used in the Justice League. It was at this point that Darkseid kind of became one of DC's high-end villains. Darkseid was not used through the end of Kirby's tenure. After Kirby left, Darkseid kind of became one of the go-to big-name villains. Now, the Return of the New Gods and Mr. Miracle didn't sell all that well, but this was during a point when DC couldn't sell anything. Look at DC from 1975 to 1978. Nothing that they started during that time sold well. Everything kind of failed. There was the big blizzard where DC had planned the DC explosion, where they were going to start a whole bunch of new books. They felt that with the Superman movie, there was going to be a lot of attention on them. They were going to be able to sell well. But there was this huge blizzard, and the distributors weren't able to get the books out for a long period of time. So bundles and bundles and bundles of stuff were being returned unopened, which is why there was a period right after the so-called DC explosion called the DC implosion, where they canceled books right and left. Stuff was canceled so fast that they actually photocopied a number of the books that were done and put them out, gave them to staffers in a thing called the DC Cancel Comics Cavalcade so they could keep the copyright. So there was a lot going on in the comics industry. DC, for some reason in the 70s, just couldn't get their feet under them. They lasted because they had Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and a Batman cartoon and a Superman movie and stuff. But their sales continued to drop all through the 70s. Kirby's ideas, on the other hand, have been woven into the fabric of DC to the point where, if you look at a lot of DC stuff, Darkseid, the New Gods, Brother Eye, all this sort of thing, that DC's about to go into a huge crossover, one of their big events, the Darkseid War. Kirby's influence, he put a huge stamp on the DC universe. If you look at the run-up to Infinite Crisis, they were using the concepts from OMAC, One Man Army, Brother Eye, the OMACs, all of this stuff. Kirby's influence on DC, while not as great as his influence at Marvel, there's no way it could be, you can't look at what DC did through the 80s, 90s, and now, and not see that they are taking Kirby's ideas and using them to create new stories. Neil Gaiman's Sandman pays a huge homage to Kirby Sandman, uses the character, uses the concepts, and I don't want to give spoilers if you haven't read Sandman, but that ending of Sandman would not have happened without Kirby's character, the Sandman. Everybody seemed to be able to get new things off of it. And it's one of the great things about Jack Kirby is not just the stories, not just the art, but the ideas and concepts are so rich that people can come to them and use them to create whole new ideas, whole new things. Sales-wise, Kirby's run at DC was unsuccessful. Artistically, the New Gods was successful. The other stuff, I think, is more successful now than it was then. I would dare say that DC has made more money off reprinting Kirby's work from the 70s than they made at the time. It is held to much higher regard. It has been thought of much better. And for me, when I look at Commandy, you know, I read it, and by the 20th issue, Kirby had his pattern down, and, you know, it was good, solid action stories, and he could have run with that for years. The Demon was okay. I think it ended when it needed to. But when you look at the New Gods, I think back to the Fantastic Four. And when you read the Fantastic Four, those first 30 to 40 issues are good. They're fun. But once Kirby gets to around issue the Battle of the Baxter Building, I think it's issue 39, he finds a higher gear. You get the Inhumans, you get Black Panther, you get Galactus, you get all these concepts, all these ideas, interspersed with other things. And Kirby had been working on the New Gods for 2 years. It took him about 3 years to get running on the Fantastic Four to where we got that brilliant, brilliant work. He was in that zone in the second year of the New Gods. And once he really got going, once he really got every gear enmeshed, I can't even comprehend the sort of stuff we would have seen in the New Gods. Kirby went back to Marvel. His run at DC concluded rather quietly, which is odd because when Kirby came to DC, it was such a big deal that the fanzines at the time did special issues. It's not like now where it's, oh, you know, we need to print a special issue. We just go, no, they, putting out a special issue of a fanzine in 1969 and 1970 was a lot of extra expense and a lot of extra work, and it was a big deal. When Kirby went back to Marvel, DC just kind of quietly let it happen. They didn't announce anything. They didn't end anything. Commandy continued. But the other stuff he was working on just kind of faded away. It was announced at a convention that Kirby had come back to Marvel. He had signed a deal that would run him from 1975 to 1978. And I don't think he came back to Marvel hat in hand, but he did come back feeling like he'd been defeated, feeling like he had failed at DC. He had been promised things that weren't delivered, once again, just like Martin Goodman at DC. He'd been able to do what he wanted to do and didn't feel he was supported. Toward the end of his tenure, it was just work for hire. And you can see that he's doing great Kirby work, but there's not that passion. So, in many ways, Kirby's second half at DC is more of a disappointment than a triumph. And then he goes back to Marvel. And Marvel was different. Stan was disengaged. He had been moved up the ladder and was spending more and more time in L.A. Martin Goodman was gone. There was new leadership, and Marvel was losing money. Marvel had late books. The late books were costing more money to print. They were throwing stuff out there. There was a new company that Martin Goodman's son started called Atlas Comics that was going to flood the shelf with a bunch of new comics. So when Kirby came to DC in 75, the comic market was in chaos. Things were changing. People who worked in the industry would say, comics aren't going to be around in another 5 years, so you need to find somewhere to go. Kirby came to Marvel, and he had a plan. And in our next episode, we'll talk about that plan. I want to thank you for listening. I enjoy doing these Kirby episodes. It's fun to go back and read the stuff and read what people have written and to just kind of put myself in that mindset of what comics were like at that time. Comics in 1975, that's when I started reading comics. That's when I was, you know, discovering superhero books. I'd always read the Archie and the Richie Rich and things like that. So Kirby's tenure at Marvel is one that I have great fondness for, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. So you're not going to have to wait as long. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for downloading the episode. And I want your feedback. You can always email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. And if you would like to buy ads on this podcast or Crazy Comics and Stories, you can It's easy. Just email me at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject advertising. These people have bought ads. Solitaire Rose Radio is brought to you by DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best, bar none, web host in the whole known universe. If you need a web page, you can't do any better than DreamHost.com. And if you use the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. Do you like snacks? Do you like tasty snacks? Do you like tasty, healthy snacks? Of course you do. Go over to Graze.com and you can get healthy, tasty snacks delivered right to your door. If you use the code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth box are free. And they've got all sorts of options. You could get them weekly, you could get them every other week, you could get them monthly. You could get a big box that's fit for sharing, or you could get a small box that's just for you, and you can hide it so nobody else has it. So use the code CORYS3R5P, that's CORYS3R5P, and your first and fifth boxes are free. I get amazing razors delivered from Dollar Shave Club for just a few bucks. Now I always shave with a fresh blade. Does that make me a genius? Of course it does. So if you want to try it, go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy and give it a try. I've been using it for over 2 years, and it's wonderful. All right, that's two episodes this week. I don't know if I'm going to have enough energy to do more, but we'll be back with more stories.